Hello, welcome to the Black Tower Podcast, a Wheel of Time podcast. I'm JD.
I'm Daniel.
And I'm Andrew.
And today we're going to be talking about Robert Jordan's The Wheel of Time, particularly The Lord of Chaos.
Yes, and before we get too far into this episode, I'll be giving the spoiler warning this time. So, if you have not read Robert Jordan's The Wheel of Time up to and through the Lord of Chaos book, you're at risk of being spoiled, and you're as fucked as the Shido L are at the end. Boom.
Wah, wah.
You'll understand when you're older.
When your warning shot actually hits the guy.
That's a court martial in there. Lord of Chaos. Lord of Chaos.
Let the Lord of Chaos rule.
Book 6 in the Wheel of Time series.
It's played halfway through.
Yeah. Book 6 and 5 were a very close tie for me for favorite book. And my reason for The Fires of Heaven being my favorite book over Lord of Chaos is none too good. But nevertheless, it is what it is. Sex igloos win out over meat grinders every time. But
I mean, you're not wrong.
That sounds like almost counterintuitive. Well, I'm not going down that path anyway. I'll be into the meat grinder.
It also depends on who you are in the whole thing.
That's probably going to be her title once she finds out someone's been talking about the sex glue.
If you told anyone, I'll be into the meat grinder. Oh, gosh. I'm going to hell for talking about a fucking fictional character now.
Yeah, we probably all are.
Yeah, I'm driving the damn bus.
That's fine. We'll have to stop and reverse and roll over many people several times along the way.
All right. Yeah. Avienda might be one of them.
All right. Seriousness. The POV breakdown. Right. Randall Thor comes in at the top spot with 28%.
Woot!
Egwene Alvear with 16%. Nynaeve comes in third with 12%, followed by Matt Cawthon. And then there's a tie with Elaine Trakan and Perrin Abera with 7%. And then Morgais Trakan and Pedro Nile with roughly 2%. Follow that is more than 10 characters with 1% or less. Entirely too many to mention.
Yeah.
I will say that Nynaeve had better be happy, because you know that if it was the other way around and Matt Cawthon was at 12 and she was at 11, she would never shut up about it.
Yeah. Though I do think there are some notable points of view to talk about in that 1% range. In that is included Pedro Nail, Fael Bashir, Samael. Gawain's not really notable.
No, Pedro Nile has about 2%. That's like 1.8.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Fael is 1.5. Men gets 0.8. Who else? Demondre gets 0.5. Suan Sanchi gets 0.4. Patton Fane, because you can't forget about him, gets 0.3. Avienda gets 0.166%. Bane actually gets 0.07%. So there's that. And there's a miscellaneous Sean Chan writer that gets 0.033%. And then in between the quotes from the prologue and the epilogue, a quote gets 0.028%.
Which is more than Dailin gets.
Yeah. And old Elorian and Luan Norwelian. Who hilariously all get about 3. Well, Luan gets 4%, but those two get 3% of chapter 43.
They're all in the same chapter and not.
Yeah. Right.
So I want to point out the note on the Shanchan writer. As this character is not named. Although, from his words, it is known he is Shanchan and has had a conversation with Matt Cawthon previously in the series. I don't remember Matt talking to any Shanchan previously in the series.
I don't know. Give us links.
Oh,
searching. I mean, I'm sure he has, but
I don't know. He's definitely in a position where he can, but it doesn't really talk of because he's with Rand and Ingtar and everybody when they storm the house with the Quendiar seal and the Horn of Valir. So I don't think it's necessarily on screen, but he is present.
Well,
I mean, doesn't he gamble with a group of like Shanshan soldiers and there's a brief exchange between them?
Don't remember that.
Well, it says previously in the series, not in the book. Like, he's had a conversation in the book. So I'm like, where?
Oh, yes.
Because I know in Ebudar, Matt would does that, but
Tanchico.
No, he wasn't in Tanchico. Matt wasn't in Tanchico. It's Ebudar.
Yes, he is.
No. Julian and Tom are in Tanchico. And that's all before the...
Well, and Rand and Matt and Perrin all show up right at the end when everything's going to shit. Because, of course, Matt has to be there to blow the horn.
That's not Tanchico. That's Tomon Head. That's Falma.
But that's outside of Tan... Oh, you're right. That's out of Falma. Sorry, not Tanchico.
Yeah, he blows the horn out of Falma.
You're right. You're totally right. It's Falma that I'm thinking, not Tanchico.
So I'm trying to... I'm thinking Matt's only interaction is Falma and Ebudar. And who was he having a conversation with in Falma?
Again, there is a number, or there are a number of off-screen moments where Rand is fighting the Blade Master in Falma, where Matt is unaccounted for as far as his point of view. Though that's not really a conversation.
That's what I'm getting at.
Rich environment, though it is a possibility.
Wait, isn't so? When they're in Ebudar, it's in Elaine and Nynaeve and Avian and all of them. After they get the Vola Winds, they escape because of the invasion by the Shanshan. But Matt, along with his soldiers, remain behind in Ebudar to find Oliver. Because it's not too far after that that Tylan starts enjoying Matt's quote-unquote company.
That's because the house falls on him.
Yeah. So, if he's there in Ebudar while it's controlled by the Shanshan, I think it's reasonable, because this is not too far before Tuon encounters Matt and they have a little bit of a fight. I think there was somewhere there where he... Anyway, we're arguing a very, very small portion of what's even important for the series.
Well, that, and it's not even in the book.
Correct.
The book ends with them getting to Ebudar.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
I can get with that.
Yeah.
Interesting. But,
yeah.
Makes me think that this unnamed Shanshan rider is actually a Forsaken. The reveals Robert Jordan didn't even know he revealed.
I feel like this like stereotypical like, you know, movie rich guy just possibly indeed.
No, I was taking a drink and he hit me with that bomb.
Did you spit it out?
That is a... No, I was trying not to.
It wasn't worth anything. If
I am not wasting good tea.
It's okay.
Sounds like a...
I'm from the South. I am not wasting sweet tea.
Okay,
fair.
I'll give you that one. Yeah, you're right. You're right on that one. So I think before we started the recording, and as our patrons are here, we were talking about how long the prologue is for Lord of Chaos and how you feel like you're reading and reading and reading and reading. And you're like, okay, I must be in like chapter 3 and you're still in the prologue. Because there's like, what did I say, 10 or 11 POVs in the prologue alone?
It is 30,000 words.
Yeah, it's so long. 30,000 words. I couldn't even write 30,000 words. And that's just the prologue for Lord of Chaos.
I have read books shorter than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've known people with theses shorter than that.
I'm going to be fair, the thesis should be shorter than 30,000 words.
It depends on your professor.
That's true. Your thesis statement should definitely be less than 30,000 words.
That's what I meant. That's what I meant, like the actual physical thesis, like being shorter than 30,000 words. Like what you're trying to say, not all your like stuff behind it or whatever, your arguments or support or whatever. English is hard. Leave me alone. Goodbye.
But yeah, the prologue for this book is pretty intense, which is one of the reasons that you kind of go into it knowing that this is going to be a fairly intense book, and it does not disappoint as far as all of that is concerned.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, at 30,000 words, that is almost half as long as Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, and over a quarter as long as Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. Because Sorcerer's Stone is 76,944 words. So literally in a prologue, Robert Jordan wrote almost half of the length of Sorcerer's Stone. And Prisoner of Azkaban is like 107,250-ish, 253 words. So he wrote over a quarter. So if you took a little over a fourth of the third Harry Potter book, he wrote that in a prologue. Like, this is just the intro to the book, basically. Now here's the book.
Okay, so the intro is about a third of the length of The Hobbit.
Jesus!
How do you compare heights like that? Because I feel like hobbits are actually about like 3 foot nine on average. Not actually about a third of... Sorry, that was terrible. I'm gonna go cry in a corner.
Like before you started getting into numbers, like it was at least like mildly entertaining, chuckle worthy, and then it just kind of was like, okay, it's kind of going down.
Yeah, no, and it's really funny because in some ways, I mean, like you know that they're not, but at the same time, like it almost feels like Robert Jordan is giving you like a previously on. Except that it's all new information. Like, very little of the prologue is actually rehashing anything, except for the next book, which I'm sure that we'll get into in the next book. But, like, all of the prologue in Lord of Chaos is new stuff. None of it is just like, okay, let's talk about what happened last book, remind you of what's going on so that you go into this fresh. It's like, no. I'm giving you 30,000 words of new information from some people that you don't actually hear from very often.
It's like the previously on one that's like, did I actually watch the last episode or did I miss it? Like, what's going on here?
Right?
I felt the prologue was supposed to be in novella. The editor did not agree with that. Like, no, we're not doing this separately. We're sticking it in the prologue.
Robert Jordan's just like kicking his shoe on the ground. Okay.
Yeah, he probably said, yeah, sure, whatever. I'm like three books down. I don't care.
Right. I know this is going to be at least 10 books long, and that's if I don't die partway through.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny, like, so remember last episode how I mentioned about when there was one of the Forsaken and we were trying to figure out who it was that tortured the Aes Sedai and her warder?
Yes.
That happens in the prologue of this book.
Simiraj. Yeah,
Simiraj that tortures the Aes Sedai. And I love how they leave out their warder. Like, she literally made this man experience so much pleasure that he died.
Yep.
And isn't that the way we all want to go?
No.
No, actually, yeah, you're right. That sounds fucking horrible.
But at the same time, I mean, like, it is in my top 10. I'm not going to lie.
At least it's in the top 10. There's an analogy I can make for that, but I'm definitely not going to.
Aww.
I'm not. I'm just not.
But I lobbed it over to you.
It reminds me of a thousand ways to die.
Oh, God. What a dumb show.
The episode with the number one way to die. Simultaneous heart attacks while having simultaneous orgasms. Ichiboned.
Yep.
Like, do you mean like one after the other, or just all like? Because simultaneous means like at the same time. So like, both at the same time, or just like continuous ones over and over and over and over again, back to back to back to back to back.
Well, I feel like your first heart attack.
Apparently, they both had heart problems.
Likely to also be your last heart attack in that particular instance. But
false.
I don't know.
Most people survived their first heart attack. Yeah, I just pulled a Dwight there. False.
Apparently, they both had heart problems that was undiagnosed.
Excuse me. False. Beats Bears Battlestar Galactica. Michael? Michael? All right, so now actually into the meat of the Lord of Chaos book.
So we've already since we've talked about that super juicy beefy prologue. So in this prologue, we meet we see Nynaeve is still messing with Suan with the power, trying to figure out a way to cure stealing. That'd be an equally amazing feat, honestly. I feel like that's just compulsion on a long-term scale.
Right.
And at the same time, that's kind of whenever Suan discovers kind of what the Adam is all about, because she can sense Mogideon through that. Yes. But can't make her feel anything and can't make her touch side air, which reinforces the belief that channeling is still linked to making the other person feel whatever sensation you want.
Yep. And she does give them a number of pieces of information about it, because of course this is one of those moments where the thought of Nynaeve and Elaine just being woefully ignorant as far as the power and using Sidar is concerned, whereas Xuan and Lyanna and, you know, most of the other Aes Sedai have way more experience and know way more about the actual ins and outs of it. And Nynaeve and Elaine are just kind of flailing in the dark comparatively.
I just picture like one of those, like, you know, the flailing tube men?
The wacky inflatable men?
Yeah, wacky inflatable arm flailing tube
men. Wavy inflatable arm flailing tube men.
I just picture those, like, but in the dark. So all you hear is like the fabric flapping around.
And occasionally they'll hit something and cure stilling. And you're like, what the fuck?
Well, they say broke clocks right twice a day.
They're not wrong.
But no, I want to point out the
even a blind nut finds a squirrel every once in a while.
I want to point out the magnitude of having the spider on string, and the fact that they aren't telling anybody.
Oh yeah, it's kind of like I think there's an interesting art piece to be done there. The spider woven and caught in a web she can't escape. Somebody please make that art a real thing and tweet it at us. Because around the same time, that's when Elaine, in the prologue, she makes an Adam without the chain, and that's what they start using on Mogideon.
Yeah, and she does the dream triangle to get them to Teleonriad, and they learn to invert weaves. They don't share that one. They learn to hide their talent. They don't learn that one. They learn the mist of mirrors. They don't share that one. They shared how to eavesdrop on people. They're making these leaps and bounds because they have the equivalent of a Nazi scientist chained up in their rooms.
They've got Einstein. They not all but offered asylum to Einstein. And now they're trying to find the atomic bomb.
They have Oppenheimer.
Yeah. I actually really like the way that they describe it in some ways in the prologue, because they're actually talking and they mention something about other sisters. Like, some of them absolutely are fascinated by these new talents and new, you know, ways of using the power and whatnot, that they're basically giving to the sisters from Mogedion. And like, they've noticed that at least a few sisters are like, oh, I kind of knew that one already, but I wasn't going to tell anybody about it because that's my secret. Like, that's my thing. And I love the idea of all of these women just like absolutely learning things and then just being like, yeah, no, I'm not going to teach anybody else because that's going to be my thing. And I'm going to be able to do that and nobody else here is. And so when, you know, Elaine and Nynaeve are coming out with all of this stuff and they're like, hey, everyone should have knowledge, they're like, damn it, that's not my thing anymore.
Well, it's kind of like, I want to say it's like the Tower of Babel or the Dark Ages, where everyone kind of knew that, but something happened and it got lost along the way. And then everyone kind of rediscovers it on their own, where they're like, ooh, this is really neat. I'm not going to teach anybody, even though at one point it was just general knowledge.
Exactly. And it almost seems like, the way that it's put in the prologue is, you know, the White Tower is just so inherently full of secrets that even when these women rediscover talents and, like, you know, amazing things, they don't even tell their fellow sisters because they're like, no, I have to keep this for myself. And the fact that, like, none of them can get on the same page and none of them actually know what to do about, you know, Rand and the Dragon Reborn and the Aiel and the Last Battle and the Dark One and all of this just makes so much sense when you're standing there being like, man, they can't even teach each other stuff that they're learning in the power. How in the world are they going to, like, fight this war against the shadow, which is also relatively dysfunctional, but at the same time, like, oh, Jesus, just talk to each other.
Well, on that, and it's kind of a point leading into another part of this, is they think they know everything, and anything that's brought to them is kind of considered trivial. Like, when they actually get to Teleon Riad, and the wise ones are telling them, you guys are a bunch of idiots, you don't know what you're talking about, and they just blow them off.
Well, it's that kind of Aes Sedai arrogance that we've seen throughout a fair portion of the series. I mean, with the exception, I would say, of Moraine, her seems like a more practical world knowledge, whereas when you get around, it's almost like when you get a group of Aes Sedai together, there's a lot of arrogance around it, because everybody's trying to prove themselves the stronger sister in one way, shape, or form. You know, it's like, you know, you act one way around your friends and another way, you know, when you're one-on-one with somebody.
Yeah, I hate, I kind of hate jumping back to military roots, but it's what I know. It reminds me of how West Pointers always look down on the ROTC guys. Like, oh, you went to a junior college and you were just ROTC. We went to West Point. Like, yeah, you went to West Point, but you're an idiot because you don't know anything about the real world. I feel like the White Tower is West Point. Like, we're tower trained. We know what we're talking about. Your little wilder tricks aren't good. We're not going to have you teach them to somebody else. When in reality, this is something that was probably used in the War of Power and probably used to a great extent, to great effect.
Yes, and of course, there are a number of times where literally just sisters come on situations where, again, very similar to what you were talking about earlier, as far as the, like, no, I can't show any weakness in front of these women because my standing depends entirely upon their opinion of me. Therefore, I have to pretend like I know everything, even if I don't. And they just, like, walk into the room and they try to take charge, and whoever is actually in charge is just like, dude, no. And then they just, like, get their panties all up in a bunch because they're like, wait, but that was my opportunity to go ahead and show that, shoot, he's a Tavir and we're screwed.
Yeah, so we do get to see a little bit of...
Anyway.
Through Nynaeve, we get to see a little bit of their budding hedge with the Wise Ones. They talk about how Sore...
We see it a lot more later with Elaine when they're... When she's trying to... after she's made the new dream Terangriel and she's teaching Sharam's circle about Telerangriel. And they're like, you don't know what you're doing, girl. Be quiet. And then they all get sucked into a fucking nightmare.
Yeah.
And she has her and Suwan have to rescue them. And even then they're like, well, you didn't come in deliberately. You were sucked in too.
Wait, no. It's one of those just smile and wave.
Yeah. Which, to be fair, I mean, like, they can't really prove that they didn't. And it is such an Aes Sedai thing to stand there at the end of the thing and be like, oh no, I definitely did that on purpose. Shut up. So it definitely sounds like they're not being genuine, even though, of course, we as readers are absolutely given the information that they definitely did it intentionally.
Yes. Yes, we are. So we're really lucky with that. And of course, that's kind of after the prologue.
Yes.
But I just wanted to mention that while we're on the topic of seeing, well, I mean, that's not with the Wise Ones, but, or with the Aes Sedai. That is with the Aes Sedai. Why did I say Wise Ones? I don't know. Brain work, please. Indeed. But, there are important things that happen, obviously, in the prologue. The tower, the White Tower, under Elaida sends an embassy to Camelin to quote unquote talk with Rand, and Min goes with him. We all know why. She wants to see the dragon reborn. Oh my.
Right.
Perrin is able to sense that Rand needs him. I think this is when they start seeing the flashes of color. When they think about each other, when they've been away from each other for a while.
Yes, he actually does mention that in some ways to Fael. Though he does it in kind of a roundabout way, because, you know, Perrin is definitely one of the... He's kind of like unintentionally very much like the man's man of the three to Viren. Like, he's the one who's the biggest, he's the one who's the strongest, he's the one who's not... Who's like the least in touch with his feelings. And so when he's talking to her, he's very bad at going ahead and describing the feeling and what's going on, but he does eventually get it out. And then as he and later on in the series, as they talk about it more, you find out more about what each of them is feeling and that it's basically the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I thought was super interesting is as you see this happen throughout the rest of the series, and slight spoiler, it's nothing major to the plot for anybody that's listening. But if you don't want to hear it, I'd say skip forward about, I don't know, 20 seconds or so. But the longer they're away from each other, they see more complete images of each other, which is supposed to indicate a higher need. So,
yep.
But anyway, not to go too far beyond, if you're hearing me talk right now, this is spoiler safe again up through Lord of Chaos. So sorry to throw a random spoiler section in there for you. But he goes to find Rand, and he's only bringing with him 200 Two Rivers men.
Only.
Only. Gawain is informed that Morgase is dead. Peddler tells Gawain that and claims that it was the Dragon Reborn that killed her.
And he starts to become the most insufferable character in all of the Wheel of Time.
What a giant pain in everybody's anus.
Yeah. Which, I mean, like, in the end, I do actually not necessarily agree with a lot of people. Because I actually think that he very much does sort of redeem himself and become less of a tool, as the books... come to a close later on. But for, I swear, like, this book and the next oh, I want to say probably 5 books. He's just the worst.
Yeah, I mean, and the biggest thing I say about that is I'm far more of a non-fan of Galen than I am of Gawain. At least in the last battle, is that Gawain remains steady. Yeah. He's motivated by logic. Very rarely is he truly motivated by heart, whereas Gawain is continuously and only motivated by heart.
Yes.
Which the inner fan, I guess, of Captain Planet, of me, can understand. kudos to anybody that actually watched Captain Planet. And I don't mean the one with what's his name? Cheadle?
Don Cheadle.
Don Cheadle. No, I don't mean that one, though. That's equally hilarious. But
right.
But yeah, I mean, but that does set Gawain full-heartedly, steadily against Ran, anything to do with Ran. It's what makes him not like Elaine's closeness to Ran, Egwene's closeness to Ran, all that. He's like, well, actually, you say he's the savior, but he's Shaitan in disguise. And
right. And I mean, like, again, this is one of the moments where it's very interesting as far as what the reader knows and what the character knows. Because on so many levels, the reader is so informed by the other events that none of the characters can actually see going on. And so, of course, we are absolutely aware that Morghese is alive. She got out of Camelin. She got out from under the thumb of one of the Forsaken, which is already in a lot of ways an accomplishment in and of itself, and then gets out to go find allies, and we know she's alive. We know that Rand had absolutely nothing to do with any of this, and that he's actually the one who killed the Forsaken who had her prisoner. But Gawain is basically flying blind. He does not have the benefit of being able to, you know, read his own book or watch his own VHS or, you know, whatever, and get information as far as what's in the future. And so I absolutely still agree that he becomes kind of insufferable in terms of the fact that he will not believe any of the people around Rand who believe in him, which is kind of bullshit. But like, at the same time, there's also strong reasons that he is convinced that it's not true, and he does not have the benefit of knowledge of what's going on in the rest of the world. So you kind of have to feel for the guy a little bit, because you're definitely like, dude, you 100% think that your mom is dead and that Rand did it.
All right, guys. So, I know we're just in the middle of talking about some of the stuff from the book, but JD's internet has dropped. He's experiencing some pretty serious storms in his area, so he may pop in and out. So JD may pop in later. He may not. We'll see what happens. But Daniel and I are going to continue on. Again, this is part of the reason for having 3 hosts on the podcast. So in case someone can't make it or has technical difficulties, we can keep going.
Because conversation with a single person is less entertaining.
Oh, yeah.
Back to the Outline.
So we already talked about how Gawain found out about Morghese, and that kind of starts his whole opposition to anything to do with Rand.
Yep.
In the prologue, we also see... this is Agenor and Balthamel, who awake in new bodies and are told by Shadar Haran. They're now called Osengar and Arangar.
Mm-hmm.
And Arangar is female, which does not please the now her. Demondred receives instructions from the Dark One and Shaul Gul. Demondred, Grendel, Simaridge, and Masana make plans. And then Samael and Grendel taunt each other. This is, I believe, when Samael sees the Sauron king and queen that Grendel has kidnapped. And he winds up slicing, I think, the king in half with a traveling portal. And Grendel's just like, one of you servants come and clean it up, and they do it. And then, like we talked about earlier, Simmerich tortures an Aes Sedai and her warder, and that's whenever Simmerich discovers what the bond between warder and Aes Sedai can do, and how killing one or torturing one affects the other. Then in Amador, Morghaes is trying to get help from King Alron. Pedronel says that she should use the White Cloaks instead. And then there was Petir Connell. It was an Andorran who was trying to help Morghaes escape the captivity in the White Cloaks, who was actually, she sees now hung as a Dark Friend. And she's pretty sure that was just a cover-up for her plans being discovered to escape. And it's at that point that she signs an agreement saying that the White Cloaks can have access to Andor.
Yep. Which, again, is one of those moments that's kind of hilarious and kind of groan-worthy, because all of us actually find out that it had nothing to do with his plans. They just kind of get caught up in a Dark Friend's search by the White Cloaks, which, if you get caught up in a Dark Friend's search, you are probably fucked.
Yeah, it's not like a happy little accident. It's a sad little accident.
Aww. Bob Ross's alter ego, Bob Ross.
Shitty's back!
Really, anything involving White Cloaks.
Yes! we'll take you as you come in and go out.
No mentioning Tavirin from here on out.
Yeah. Neither of those two who shall not be named now. That's twice we've mentioned them and you've disappeared. Right. So, one of you guys want to take us from after Morghaes signs the treaty with the White Cloaks, giving them access to Andor?
So an ambassador. Wow. Start here now.
An ambassador.
An ambassador from. An ambassador from the White Tower arrives to put her off. She is told more time is needed before a decision can be made. This is all in Saladar, which we've already been talking about with Elaine and Nynaeve being in Saladar and making the Tehran Greal. Nynaeve overhears this, and using need, she and Elaine look in the world of dreams for an object to force them to help Rand. After first being taken to the tower, they change their search and they change their need, and it sends them to Ebu Dar, where they find a bowl-shaped Tehran Greal that Elaine believes will fix the weather. This is all after Nynaeve gets very frustrated that Shiriam and her circle in the hall aren't making a decision, because of course she thinks that they should just be done with it and go against the Lyda, but of course they are dragging their feet pretty significantly.
But the next half gets pretty interesting. JD, you want to hit us up with there?
I'm gonna try. Theridan gets Nynaeve drunk and tries to clear her block. Angry about this and other things, Nynaeve accidentally heals Loghain of Gentling. She repeats this process with Swan and Lian, and though they are only partially healed, the Yells are surprised by her use of all five powers. They grab her and make her demonstrate it repeatedly. Lian and Swan visit her later to ask her to try again, because their low strength means they will not be very influential. Erengar arrives and stays with Delanna, which is more White Tower. We've always done it this way. We know what we're doing, and you're an idiot.
Yeah. We told you it was impossible. Fucking stop.
Yeah, I think what's interesting there is they're all talking about, like, oh, it's interesting that she used spirit this way, and interesting that she used water this way and fire this way. We never thought of that. That's crazy. Oh, no, that's dangerous. How could she ever do that? And it's like, Y'all are just mad because a wilder showed up and showed you how to heal something that you thought was permanent. And it turns out it's really not. Anything that can be cut can be healed. And that's pretty much what Nynaeve works from. She's like, she's making these whole remarks. There's like a void that feels like I can feel it. I can fill it, F-I-L-L. And that's essentially what she winds up doing, because at a point she's like half drunk, which is fucking hilarious in and of its own right. And she's like, you know what? Fuck it. Loghain, I'm going to pour everything I have into you, which sounds dirty the more and more you think of it. But
Pretty on brand for us.
Yeah.
At this point.
Yeah. I think it's more so just like my trademark. Like, I bring the dirty, naive, like 13, 14 year old humor to the podcast. That's all I'm good for. But it works. Just like when Nynaeve's healing of gentling and instilling, it works.
Bringing it back around.
Yeah, it's just as unconventional. Everybody else is angry, but they're just mad. They hate us because they ain't us.
And we're back.
Yeah, it's a good movie. Anyway, so then we see another dynamic kind of POV change to the next significant event where we're back in Camelin and Rand is practicing the sword in front of sociopathic nobles with anyone. And he's like, anyone that wants to fight me, bring it on. Come on, I can do it. And he winds up fighting.
That's a sycophant.
Yes, sycophantic.
Oh, you are right. English is hard.
It's all good.
It'd be more interesting if they were psychopathic, but
I don't know. I think that some of them actually are. They're just doing a very good job of not showing it in front of a person who is possibly schizophrenic and also very powerful.
Yeah.
All I can think of is like, and I can't remember if it's in a previous book or later or whatever, where Rand's like in the empty room and he's like, I'm not crazy.
Yep.
But, so yeah, in front of, what'd you say, sycophantic nobles?
Sycophantic
nobles. Drivan Bashir, who we know is Fael's father, tries to stab him to make the point that Rand doesn't need to use a sword, and he's stopped only by Rand's quick actions.
I want to point out that all of Saldea lacks a social filter.
Truth.
This entire exchange with Drivan Bashir and Rand is very similar to Fael's interactions with everybody. They're just going to say what's on their mind or demonstrate it in the most direct way possible.
Hey, man, they wear their hearts on their sleeves because that's the only way to live, and life is too short for the bullshit of disguising motives. All right. This is a very stark, relieving contrast to the White Tower. But at the same time, she can be as equally confusing as the Aes Sedai are, but on the opposite side, by showing so much emotion. We see so many times that parents just like, what do you want? I don't know. What do you want? It's not that simple. What do you want? And to be fair, I only know that quote from the meme, not the movie. So
indeed,
don't fucking go there with me, all right? You want to fight?
I also like how, like, I, for ever so tiny of a moment, I was like, wait, is that going to be our obscure movie quote? And then I was like, no.
No.
It's not
no.
Obscure.
No, it's not obscure enough. I think
one of those requirements.
But so after that, we see that our good old boy, Mazrim Tain, arrives in Camelin and claims to want a compact between them, but agrees to merely serve when Rand refuses. He's like, bruh, can we just be allies? And Rand's like, oh, fuck you. You're under me. And Mazrim Tain's like, okay. But he's not happy. And we see that in the far, far future. But foreshadowing, Rand wonders about his own sanity. And realizes that he doesn't like Mazrim Tain. Tain gives Rand one of the seals on the Dark One's prison, which Lewis Ayerson's voice insists he must destroy. Another steaming, heaping pile of hot foreshadowing. They travel to a nearby farm where there are candidates to learn channeling. Because Mazrim Tain is like, look, you wanted me to go find people now, and I've brought a bunch of people together. Let's go talk to them.
This isn't there yet.
Oh, it's not there?
Mazrim Tain shows up, and Rand has put out the call for men who can channel.
Oh, yes, off an asylum, yeah.
Mazrim to them and says, hey, can any of them actually channel? How about you let me know, and then we'll have a conversation about you going and finding more people later.
Hey, potential asshole I just met that I'm pretty sure I don't like already because the voice in my head tells me I don't like you.
Right.
Which honestly leaves a lot of, it leaves a lot of credit to Luz Theron at that point, honestly.
Well, I want to point out that Rand didn't tell him to like serve him until Luz Theron was like, no, we need to kill this guy now. So in Rand's point of view, it was like, no, you're going to be lower than me because if we were partners, you're probably going to betray me.
I mean, let's be fair. The entire series, even through the Lord of Chaos, Rand's like, oh, wait, this person's an enemy. How about I make you an ally and you just work with me and we'll just shake on it. It'll be fine.
Kind of.
It always works out perfectly fine, right? Everything's peachy keen.
That's kind of Rand's MO, which, of course,
nothing's more disarming than a smile. Right?
Which, again, is one of those moments where it's very much like the Harry Potter thing of, like, why do you always lose? Because you're standing there alone where we've made allies.
It's kind of like DBZ. It's kind of like, why does Goku always get in a bad position? Well, because he lets down his guard, and he's like, oh, I'll let you charge up. Well, that's more Vegeta than Goku, honestly. Because he did let Cell go to Perfect Cell.
Well,
you're not wrong.
That's just like, you know, I want you at your best. But this is more...
What is this like? What is the anime Chivalry of a Dell Knight? Chivalry of a Failed Knight. Jesus Christ, English. Where it's like, I'll beat your best with my best.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm an anime nerd. Otaku out!
Yeah.
You're all good. So, interesting fact about Mazrim Time. There's actually a number of notes that have been discovered, read over, however you want to. I mean, like, it was voluntarily given, so it wasn't like, you know, oh, we found something or whatever. But someone read Robert Jordan's notes, and he actually originally intended in this book to throw all of the information at you that Mazrim Taim was absolutely without a doubt Demandred.
What?
But he went too hard in some ways. And so he actually decided before the reveal that Mazrim Taim was actually Demandred, that it was actually going to be a different person and that he was going to go in a different direction. But it's actually interesting to read this book again, and actually the next one, with the idea that at this point, Robert Jordan actually was not only considering, but had basically made the decision that Taim was Demandred.
Dude, you just blew my fucking mind.
Right?
It fits, too.
It fits so well.
It does.
Theron goes absolutely apeshit anytime a Forsaken is mentioned. And he has that reaction for Taim every single time. And while he absolutely did not like the rest of the Ashaman, and he's very uncomfortable with them,
he doesn't lose his shit the same way, yeah.
Exactly. It's a very different response.
Like, it's almost like a PTSD response from Luz Theron.
Yeah.
Not even that.
Oh, wait, sorry. Luz Theron. I pronounced his name wrong. Sorry, go ahead.
But Demandred is always number two.
Mm-hmm.
Samael and Luz Theron were like neck and neck, but Demandred's like in their shadow. And yep. Mazrim Taim is set up in that exact same position.
He is. He's always in Rand's shadow. Oh, dude, I see it now. Now that you've mentioned it, it's almost, right? It's like one of those things, like once you see it, you can't unsee it. Like, I'm so dumb for not seeing it the first time.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's interesting because, of course, when I first read the books, you know, ages ago now, when this one, actually this one was already out when I started reading, I think. But anyway, when I first started reading it, I was convinced that Mazrim Taim was actually Aghanor come back from the dead, basically. And that he had killed Mazrim Taim, taken over his body, and was now just acting like Mazrim Taim. Which is weird, because there's like this mini exchange between him and Bashir right at the beginning, but it's so non-committal from Taim that you're just like, oh, I'm not actually even sure who you are, who you say you are. And they even like say that from Rand's point of view in the book. But then, of course, later it's revealed that Dimmendred is a completely different person and Aegonor is a completely different person. And, you know, all of the Forsaken are accounted for. So I was just like, huh, I guess I was just an idiot. And then, of course, later on, there was this, you know, sort of person who went through the notes and they were like, hey, originally this was true. And I was like, thank you. Thank you so much. I feel so vindicated.
All right. The rest of the podcast is just absolute silence. Everybody can to consider what Daniel just dropped on everybody.
Right.
So thank you for tuning in. No, I'm just kidding. Holy shit. Where did you find that? Or I mean,
so I was actually, it was brought to my attention through Reddit because there was actually a person who commented or who made a post on, you know, the Wheel of Time thread about Mazrim Taim being telegraphed so hard to be a Forsaken, and that he was frustrated that
he wasn't,
that never actually ended up coming to fruition. And then somebody else went ahead and made a comment on that particular post about this thing. And so I went and researched it because I was like, I'm not just going to believe some rando on the internet.
Especially on Reddit.
Especially on Reddit.
Yeah.
But it's totally true. I mean, like, there is more than just, you know, anonymous comment on it. If you look this up, there are, you know, a number of different people who have gone through the available notes and have made this discovery and whatnot. And so you are still definitely hearing it secondhand, because unless you actually get access to Robert Jordan's notes, you're kind of just shit out of luck as far as like actually proving it. But at the same time, there is enough, you know, support from multiple sources that this is true, that I am relatively convinced that the people who are saying so aren't lying.
Oh yeah. So there's, if you go to the wot.fandom.com and you look at the entry on Mazrim Taim and you scroll to the bottom where it says Dark Friend Theories, it says it is widely speculated that Taim was Dimmendred in disguise, and it cites number 12. The Dimmendred theory has been debunked in at least two places. Robert Jordan has explicitly said in an interview, source L Fantasy Fair, 8 April 2001, report by Anne Aline. So apparently Lan reported that. And Dimmendred also expressed surprise and confusion over finding a man who can channel in a black coat. Well, that could be written after, at the Battle of Shadar Logoth. So that's not really, that doesn't debunk it. Now, I could see the one like Robert Jordan saying it, but that could also be after the fact that he was like, no, he never was. And it's like, well, he might have been. But evidence towards this is that he refers to the IL as the so-called IL, of reference to Dashang IL, which has been made before by the Forsaken. In the same conversation, he mentions serving, a term only used by the Forsaken, or severing. Severing is now referred to as stilling, gentling, or being burned out. Taim also makes reference to using compulsion on a peace delegation sent by Bashir, which is quoted in Lord of Chaos Chapter 2. So I think there's far more evidence for than against. I believe it. If Robert Jordan did not intend for this to be how it was, he at least considered it.
Yes.
Here's another one. Another theory was that Taim, in fact, Morden in disguise. Which, that would be interesting as well.
That would be interesting.
Is Morden reborn by this point?
Yes.
Is he? I can't remember when he was reborn. I can't remember the book.
So you don't actually see him yet, because he doesn't actually pop up as a character that you're familiar with until the next one.
So it's kind of like the theory that some of the earlier Murdral that they encounter actually Shadar Haran.
Yeah.
For example. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Either way, it doesn't matter if it's like legit or not, to be perfectly, I mean, it does, but to be perfectly personally honest, I just love the fucking headcanon as it is.
Right.
Like, just, could you imagine the fucking mic drop, fucking Tarmageddon shows up and imagine Tame just lets like the mist of mirrors drop and it's like, it's the Mondred, bitch.
I've been here the whole time.
The whole time.
No.
You get it? Time. Time.
Yeah. And that's when Rand just murders him horribly. And it's just like, you know what? I was actually considering letting you live, you know, like I let Asmodee in. Oh, it was also another, this was just a theory. This was not actually in the notes, but there was actually a theory going around that based on the, you know, the fact that all of this was telegraphed and whatnot, that Taim actually kills Asmodian to make sure that he can't let Rand know who he actually is. Because we never actually discover who killed Asmodian. It's literally left a mystery. Whole book series.
And that's something we can get into, like, if we do an episode on Asmodian, because there's a good breakdown that I love that I think makes a very strong argument for who it was.
Yes. And definitely there are.
I think it'd be another interesting headcanon that it was Mazrim Tame, you know, as himself, that kills Asmodian to help secure his position amongst the Dark Friends. We're going to leave it at that for the future. That could be another interesting headcanon. Yeah. Oh, I'm so excited. Yep. It's like I just took a Viagra for my brain. feel free to sound bit that and turn that into a meme for all of you that wish to. I perfectly 100% support it. It has the Black Tower seal of approval.
All right. Well, now that we've blown hearts and minds.
Yeah, so the theory about Mazrim Tame just has my mind blown. And I think we can all agree that that's a great place to cut off this episode to keep it not super long and do this as a part one for the dragon. I mean, Jesus, for Lord of Chaos book review. Yeah. So, with that being said, an idea that we talked about and had before recording was something that could be fun and interesting to do with those of you that listen. This podcast episode, it's towards the end. It'll be scattered throughout random parts of the podcast and future episodes, so nobody can just skip to the end, say I heard it, and tweet it out. But randomly throughout episodes from this point on, we are going to include random movie quotes.
And they are going to get harder and harder.
Oh, yeah. To be fair, this first one that we're using is not one that I have honestly seen, as much as I'm ashamed to admit it, and I'm sure that will not be the last time I say it. However, we're going to put out a random movie quote, and the first person on Twitter to tweet at Tower Podcast, that's our Twitter for the Black Tower Pod, with what movie the quote is from. And you just get bonus points if you can say who said it and so on from there, what year, blah, blah, blah. Feel free to show off. But the first person to tweet at us with the movie quote and what movie it's from will receive a shout out from us on Twitter. And for those of you that are like, well, what good is a shout out on Twitter? Right now, as of this recording on the 5th of June, that goes out to 855 people, which I know it's not a crazy ton. But hopefully you love us enough where you think that's fantastic.
Do also remember that that's a little over 800 Wheel of Time fans.
Yes.
Which are worth at minimum
three fans a piece.
Yeah, I think at least three people.
So that's like 3,200, a little over 3,200 in terms of quality over quantity.
Yeah. Just saying.
So, JD, you want to hit us with that quote?
Yeah. It's good to be the king.
Damn straight it is. It's very good to be the king. So that is your random movie quote. In future episodes, again, it'll be scattered somewhere throughout the podcast. We don't want to make it unfair to anybody that may just skip to the end. So definitely, you're going to have to listen to the podcast to find out where it is.
Curious question, Andrew.
Uh-huh.
If we end up using a quote that is then quoted in other movies afterwards, referencing back to that movie, does it count to say the newer movies, or does it have to go all the way back to the original?
It's got to be the original, because we are looking for a specific one.
And all right, I'm down.
I'm going to say, yeah, we have to use the original movie quote, which you, however, if you say quoted in this movie, which is also quoted in this movie, if it's something like that, then we will figure out something special to do for you for having gone above and beyond. You will get more than just a shout out and retweet on Twitter.
Nice. I like it.
Because you deserve it, because you're going above and beyond. If you can say, like, well, this is quoted in movie A, which quoted it from movie B, then that, I mean, to me, that deserves it. But remember, it's only the first.
Yes, right? Indeed.
So even if the second, third, or fourth person to tweet back at us where the quote's from goes that far beyond, it's only based off of the first tweet that identifies the quote. Now, if the first person that tweets back with the quote is from a movie that quotes the movie we took it from, then you can definitely steal that from them. And the three of us will be checking that to make sure we're not missing something.
Nice. No participation trophies.
Besides, if you know that's quoted in another movie, it's original.
Truth.
Daniel, if they wanted to go to a singular URL website that would give them access to any links to contact us and also a contact method for us via email, what URL would they type?
Then they would go to blacktowerpod.podbean.com to go ahead and get all of the information about downloading the podcast and all of the contact information for all the social medias that all of us are on, just in case they wanted to talk to their favorite host one-on-one or just give us props.
And JD, if they just wanted to straight tweet at us or send us a message on Twitter, what Twitter handle would they be looking for?
They'd be looking for at Tower Pod on Twitter, or myself at Force Rider Jane.
Shameless plug. And for those of you, the T and P in Tower Pod, Tower Podcast rather, are capitalized. I'm not sure if it makes a difference searching it. I haven't noticed it has, but whatever have you. And for those of you that don't want to go to either and just want to be able to hear it and reach out to us straight via email, you can reach us at blacktowerpod@gmail.com. Those are the three main and easiest ways to get in contact with us. We encourage listener feedback, viewer feedback across anything. When you go to, like Daniel said, when you go to the Podbean site, you'll see links on the left that take you to our Twitter, the YouTube that Podbean automatically puts the episodes on, the Facebook page that we have, as well as the link to join the Discord that we all chat in, which we love seeing new people join, as well as the Patreon for those of you that wish to get some extra content, some bonus content, some unedited content for the most part, depending on what tier you join at, which you can see all that on Patreon. If you feel so inclined to go that far above and beyond with us. But this has been part one of Lord of Chaos. It's not exactly halfway through the book, to be fair. It's closer to the first quarter to third of the book. But next week we'll be back with part two, where we cover the rest of the book, where we will cover, sorry, the rest of the book, to include what is probably widely accepted as, if not the most, the second most exciting chapter in the entire Wheel of Time series.
Agreed.
Yes, it's going to be an epic thing when they get to it in the show.
Oh, yeah.
So for those of us at the Black Tower Podcast, I have been Daniel.
I'm JD.
And I'm Andrew.
And this is us signing off. See you next week.